Well, Jeremiah and I have been working together for about 4 years on contemporary fiction from Eastern Europe, from a variety of directions. And the project that we took on this time, I think we have learned something. We have too big a project. I've scaled some things down here today. And it isn't that it's too big to fit into the time. It's that there are four different strains or strings or something that we're trying to do. And it's a little hard to follow them if I race off too much. So we're condensing things a little bit. But what we set out to do was simultaneously to talk about the method by which Andrzej Czbiorski has done what he does in The Beautiful Mrs. Seidman, a novel from 1986, in demonstrating how, in terms of this conference, temperance is a sin. It's one of the worst insults you can direct toward God. And then comparing and contrasting what Czbiorski has done with what the Czech novelist Ivan Klima has done in Waiting for the Dark, Waiting for the Light, in the reverse way, not by showing a positive image of someone who has said yes to God, but by showing the consequences of a moderate, a temperate, a restrained response to God's call in our lives. And then to take the third by the Polish novelist Marek Hosko and talk about the world as it develops when the human being is seen. And here's where Jeremiah really comes in to talk about the wickedness of the immoderate understanding of the presence of the Imago Dei in your fellows. And so I'm going to start by talking about the method by which Czbiorski compels us to look eye to eye at the positive image that he has. And his method for doing that is by throwing us completely off balance morally from the beginning of the novel. So I'm going to summarize and read you passages from the scene with which the novel opens, which is a dismaying experience for people who are reasonably morally confident. Let's begin with a silly question. Is peace a desirable state of affairs? In fact, let us begin with a ludicrous question. In Warsaw, in the spring of 1943, would peace be a desirable state of affairs? And there is, of course, nothing silly about the question, as Judge Romnicki and the Taylor Kujawski explore its implications in the opening scene of The Beautiful Mrs. Seidman. The judge meets Kujawski's fervent wish that the war end with a gentle reminder that perhaps something more complex is called for than a simple idealistic yearning for an end to the killing. And now I'm quoting from the first chapter of the novel. "Well, all right, let the war end," said the judge. "At once, this very moment. Would you want that, my dear friend?" "Who wouldn't, Your Honor?" "Please consider carefully. I'm being absolutely serious. Peace is the most important thing, isn't it? So let us end this war. At once, without a moment's delay." "Be very careful, Mr. Kujawski. Where are the Soviets?" "Let's say they're at the River Don." "The British and the Americans?" "In North Africa." "Splendid. So our dear Adolf Hitler controls Europe. And today we end the war, Mr. Kujawski, because you were so kind as to point out that peace is the most important thing. Isn't that so?" At this point, the judge goes into a mordant passage where he summarizes what life under the oppressors will be like, and in these horrifically ironic tones talks about how after a little while their slaves, our children, will get a piece of candy and perhaps a little painted wooden toy, and that we'll be lacking only one thing, and that is the freedom to do things our way or to wish to do things our way. And I have summarized what I could have been a little more expansive about. The judge's quiet but bitter outburst rattles the poor little tailor, a man whose death less than 100 pages later occurs in the glow of an entirely Christ-like forgiveness of those who are about to murder him. And the tailor tries to recover his balance. "Your Honor, but please," he muttered, "I want peace, of course. but under different conditions. First, Hitler must go. For Hitler to go, there has to be another war, Mr. Kujawski, said the judge. So what will it be, my friend? Doesn't peace suit you anymore this evening? Are you already yearning for battle? Shchepiorsky's purpose in opening this remarkable novel with so disconcerting an exchange is not simply to remind the reader that any attempt to translate ideals into actions is going to be hedged with unexpected complexities, uncomfortable implications, and an array of unintended consequences. Rather, he opens his book with the first of a half dozen scenes or circumstances designed carefully to disrupt the reader's confidence in moral clarity. Are we supposed to see Sister Veronica as simply engaged in the noble act of saving the lives of innocent Jewish children? Or ought we be uncomfortably aware that literally, literally, in the shadow of the crucifix, she is teaching, all her energy is directed towards teaching children to lie about their lives, their pasts, their very identities? Is it appropriate for us to regard Viktor Suchoviak as a morally admirable character for risking his life in smuggling a little Jewish girl out of the ghetto? Or should we take him at his word and regard him as utterly crass and dishonorable, motivated by nothing but lust for money? How are we to be comfortable in regarding Jost Muller as one of the most deeply decent and moral people in the book, given the little gold eagle and swastika pin glistening in his lapel? What, after all, ought a good, deontologically oriented Christian make of the lesson of the rescue of Mrs. Seidenman from the Gestapo, a rescue that vividly embodies the principle that ye shall know the truth, and a lie shall make you free? Is it not disconcerting that even pacifistic Christian readers are inclined to cheer when the unspeakable, beautiful Lolo receives the battering that he so profoundly deserves? Shchepiorsky is relentless in confronting the reader with circumstances defined by troubling and ambiguous moral implications. None but a flat-out pragmatist or relativist is permitted to be comfortable in the book. And yet neither Shchepiorsky nor this novel is even remotely to be thought of as relativist in orientation. The sympathetic portrait in chapter 19 of the mind and soul of SS officer Stuckler is deeply disquieting, but Shchepiorsky himself is not seduced by his understanding of and sympathy for Stuckler into abandoning his conviction that there are in fact divinely ordained rights and wrongs, goods and evils, and that Stuckler is proudly in the service of a great evil. Ultimately, in fact, the book is powerfully committed to a Christian vision of absolutes, particularly the absolute value of the virtue of saying here to God, without qualification, without reservation, without, dare I say it, any hint of moderation or temperance. And here lies the center of my argument about the structure of this novel and its contrast with the other novels we're considering. Shchepiorsky confronts his reader with 200 pages of morally ambiguous, complex, and problematic situations, decisions, interactions, in part to remind us how foolish it is to be simplistic. Parenthetically, peace, proclaims Kujawski, never reflecting that to people 50 miles down the tracks from Treblinka there might be moral desiderata or imperatives that take precedence over peace. I thought this morning that that was an interesting quote from Merton in the course of offering pacifistic principles to name Auschwitz. I'd be very interested to know how Auschwitz is going to be liberated without some shedding of blood. But in part to highlight dramatically the one moment in the book at which there is simply no ambiguity, no doubleness, no doubtfulness, no equivocality, no yes but of any kind. In other words, because the book is constructed almost entirely of morally troubling decisions and actions, the one absolutely unequivocal and straightforward moment in the book calls attention to itself like a combat boot on a dinner plate. The moment comes late on an evening in spring when the judge answers the phone and agrees to arrange safe haven for a four-year-old girl smuggled from the ghetto. Quote, the judge's shadow on the wall bent under the burden of the decision, for he now bore on his shoulders responsibility for a human life, end quote. After the phone goes dead, the judge walks into the next room and sits on the bed. Here, the judge said loudly, as if his name had just been called, end quote. And of course, his name has just been called, not by a voice in Warsaw, from either side of the ghetto wall. What Judge Romnicki has just done is to say yes to God's unequivocal call to be committed, to be wholly, unreservedly, immoderately, intemperately committed to God's way and God's call in our lives. God has not called the judge, nor does he call us to be cautious or practical or hesitant or safe. God has not called the judge to consider what the world would regard as sensible or wise or prudent. Indeed, the judge understands, as we are all supposed to understand, that when it comes to responding to God's call, the prudential wisdom of the world is an abomination. Moderation or temperance in this situation is not wise. It is lukewarm, and we will deserve our fate when we are spewed out of his mouth for having chosen the temperate way in responding to him. Notice that in complete, nearly violent contrast with the other examples of moral action in this novel, there is absolutely no yes but. There is no troubling downside, no uneasy ambiguity, no doubt, doubleness. Without moderation, the judge has said here, and that is simply and wholly how it is supposed to be. And without equivocation, Andrzej Szczepiorski has told us that the only proper answer to the question, what matters, what ought I to do, is say yes, say here. And because the rest of the book is defined by continuing recognition that there are virtually no simple answers, the author is exempt from any eye-rolling criticism that his answer is simplistic, naive, unrealistic, foolish, shallow, cheap, or otherwise cheesy. Nope, here is a man who knows how complicated and troubling all those questions and answers are, and yet he remains wholly and uncompromisingly committed to the principle that an entirely unmoderated and intemperate saying here to God is the only spiritually healthy course open to every individual. And then very quickly, before turning this over to Jeremiah, then in perfect companion piece or other bookend to Szczepiorski's depiction of the positive example of how a non-temperate response to God is the route to strength, health, and fulfillment, even in death, Ivan Klima ushers us into the consciousness, emotions, and spiritual life of Pavel, a man who has flinched away from saying here to God, and in having embraced the moderation of a temperate, cautious, and worldly response, has cauterized himself and walks the world a dead man. Even when the judge is saying here, in response to orders from the prison guards, that's something you don't know about in the book, he's actually saying here to God. When Pavel says here, he is speaking to the regime, and he is saying, reporting for duty to be complicit in your suppression of God, truth, liberty, and human dignity. And he has so damaged himself by that careful, practical, carefully moderated response that none of the worldly benefits that he has acquired, a sports car, decent housing, a lover, relatively loose restrictions on his actions, none of them means a thing to him. He is like the man in the joke who says, I'd give my right arm to be ambidextrous. I'm going to, to summarize Pavel before I turn Pavel and Bosco over to Jeremiah, what makes Pavel so powerful and tragic an example of an embodiment of the horrible consequences of being temperate in respect to God and liberty, comes with his insight when the wife of the corrupt businessman pours out her heart to him and he realizes, quote, wretchedness was the lot of those who hadn't the strength to be honorable or the courage to be dishonorable. Wretchedness was the lot of those who, under all circumstances, remain in the middle. Take that, Aristotle. What is it that Szczepiorski and Klima know that makes it possible for Judge Romnicki always to say here to God, even under the very moment that his candle goes out, while Pavel remains lukewarm and is therefore dead for literally decades before the end of his physical existence? Two things, it seems to me. In the first place, the judge is neither hesitant nor temperate in his response to God's call, while Pavel hedges his responses, careful to avoid any kind of commitment that cannot be kept moderate, kept under control, kept temperate. And in the second and final place, the reason for this difference between these men can be tracked back to their answers to the question that the mad and corrupt old dictator asks in Klima. Quote, you want clemency, you want freedom and power, but for what purpose? End quote. Or the judgment offered by Peter a few pages further on, quote, you always claimed you were waiting for freedom. It seems to me you could use it for something better than this. End quote. Because Pavel has chosen the unimpassioned, uncommitted, moderate road, he has no idea of what to do with freedom, and he is left in the last image of the story, he reaches out, he thinks he's going to clutch a hand, a human hand, and clutches the void. The judge, on the other hand, has said here to God. As a result, God gives him a purpose and the courage and the strength to fulfill that purpose. Temperance is for losers.
Thank you, Victor.
So I have to begin with a poem as a way to help us contextualize this literature from Eastern Europe. W.H. Auden has a poem called The More Loving One. Looking up at the stars, I know quite well that for all they care, I can go to hell. But on earth, indifference is the least we have to dread from man or beast. How should we like it were stars to burn with a passion for us we could not return? If equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. Admirer as I think I am of stars that do not give a damn, I cannot, now I see them say, I missed one terribly all day. Were all stars to disappear or die, I should learn to look at an empty sky and feel its total dark sublime, though this might take me a little time. The writers of Eastern Europe, I think, have chosen to be the more loving one in the face of secular excess. They recognize that true freedom has little to do with license and everything to do with civic, relational, and moral responsibility. The cardinal virtues are central to a vibrant Christianity. It could be argued that certain eras inspire the church to place a greater emphasis on one particular virtue or over another in response to the pervading zeitgeist. The Renaissance, with its deification of the human person, demanded a promotion of temperance over humanistic idolatry. Slavery stirred America's sense of justice in religious and civic arenas through abolitionist and legislative efforts. Throughout Western history, there is a binding and a loosening, a tension between the thesis of the human condition and the antithesis of Christian doctrine. This extends beyond moral principles to include aesthetic trends as well, these trends that Vic and I have seen so clearly in the literature of Eastern Europe. Imagine if Rococo hadn't been tempered by the compositions of Johann Sebastian Bach. If 19th century artistic sentimentalism hadn't been offset by the minimalism of modernity. Clearly this binary retains a golden mean of modesty, moderation, and good taste when it is informed by sound moral principles. The contemporary literature of Eastern Europe, from those countries that endured the full force of communist and socialist ideology, exists apart from the cultural dynamic just described. While temperance is a necessary response to the egotism and avarice of an affluent society, whether it be Las Vegas or Medici-ruled Florence, the writers of Eastern Europe reject temperance as a viable response to their suppression of freedom. Here is a literature that, unlike the Renaissance, must reaffirm the human person as imago Dei rather than merely animal. This is a literature of restoration, a literature intent on distancing itself from the baseness of communism and the suffering it has wrought. Two authors in particular, Marek Klaskal and Ivan Klima, are defiant in the face of the state's efforts to condition and pacify the general public. Klaskal's The Eighth Day of the Week and Klima's Waiting for the Dark, Waiting for the Light provide clear examples of this endeavor. The Eighth Day of the Week is a depiction of post-war Poland. According to the novel's protagonist, Agnieszka, quote, each of us has to help himself, end quote. The promises of government have regressed into an inferno Dante would be familiar with, a world where, quote, all were drinking beer, vodka, and cheap wine straight from the bottle. They choked as they drank, and the liquor splashed over their sores and onto their hands, onto their sweaty shirts and their soft, relaxed bodies. Women are publicly humiliated in the streets. Unemployment fosters a malaise of societal indifference. It is against this backdrop of despondency that Agnieszka's brother, Gregor, serves as a kind of John the Baptist, a voice crying in the wilderness. That Gregor chooses to sermonize from his daily perch at the bar lends a particular irony to the story. He says, before every good human feeling, we should kneel as before a shrine, as before a star. We should protect it, carry it like a light. And if there is even a little spark left, blow to or out of breath, this is the 20th century. Gregers advocates a life of art and prayer as the first steps towards spiritual recovery and meaning. His admiration, quote, to Neil, life gives no guarantees regarding the future, runs counter to the Orwellian policy of an atheist state. To engage in art and prayer moderately, to promote temperance in the face of pervasive moral and social decline, would be an exercise in futility. Gregers is interested in a life of thoughtful insubordination. Nothing less will suffice. The characters in Ivan Klima's novel live by the same creed. Waiting for the dark, waiting for the light is just as bleak as Glasgow's vision of postmodernity, but offers viable examples of the kind of action Gregers endorses. In Klima's world, redemption is possible in ways not fully realized by Gregers and Agnieszka, namely through political dissidence. Now, this is the activism of Solzhenitsyn, not the sophomoric belligerence of America's youth. It is Pavel, a propagandist for the government, who questions the motivation of this defiant display. Quote, what did they believe in, he asks, that made them willing to endure being beaten, locked up, dismissed from their jobs? Was their protest for some higher cause, or were they only there because there wasn't enough else to interest or motivate them? Were they simply bored? The disconnect between the resistance of the students and Pavel's own jaded cynicism plays itself out during the course of the novel. If Pavel admits, quote, that you must not live without purpose, that you must look to the consequences of your actions, live in a way that brings harm or pain to no one, and you must leave some trace of yourself behind, and that trace would be a work of art, end quote, the students model the kind of behavior Pavel must embrace. Perhaps temperance, above all other virtues, is the truest litmus test of civilized society, a society Klasko and Klima wrote towards and eventually realized. For within the disciplines of self-control and restraint, the musician is able to master the concerto, the poet finds his or her apt metaphor, and humanitarian innovation manifests itself in sciences. We would do well to consider how well our own culture promotes temperance and whether or not we too are headed towards the kind of dystopia Klasko and Klima have endured and resisted in their art.
These are awful good books, folks.
Just in comment on your ending, you reminded me of a quotation. I don't know if you're familiar with it, and I haven't seen it published in 50 years. The novel Mr. Blue. Anyhow, he has this famous quote. He says, in moderation lies mediocrity. Yeah, you might have, I haven't heard that in years, but that seemed to fit exactly.
Remember the flag that he flies on top of the roof? Courage.
Miles, what was his name?
Miles Connelly.
Connelly, that's it. Miles.
Believe it or not, he was a graduate of the school that I worked
at. Oh, is he? Okay.
In recent decades, though, our most noted graduate has been the fellow who starred on Gilligan's Island.